It first struck me about 2 years ago when I attended a conference at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, which was devoted entirely to the Harlem Renaissance, and they had a specialist in sociology, one in history, one in literature, one in economics, one in art, but none in music. And I came merely to learn about black culture in general, or be reawakened, as some people need to be. And it struck me that there was an awful lot of music going on during this time, and that we were discussing everything else about the Harlem Renaissance, but nothing was said about this age, which was a great jazz and blues age, and was a very time when many black musicians came to the forefront and were finally getting a lot of payment for the work that they had done earlier in the century, in contrast to the 1930s, when the jazz musicians, black ones I'm referring to, starved to death, pretty much except for Duke and Count and a few others, because the white jazz musicians were the ones who took over the styles and made the money. So this is pretty much the background of my research into this area, or the catalyst for what started it. Actually, the precise title that my paper has is The State of Afro-American Music During the Harlem Renaissance, and it will include both secular and sacred music, because as we know, as I hope to show, there is frequently a thin dividing line between what is sacred and what is secular in our music. Much has been written about the phenomenon which Alain Locke called the Negro Renaissance, and which is more now commonly known as the Harlem Renaissance, because Harlem was its recognized center. This Renaissance was of short duration. It depends upon which authority you talk to. Some people, like Charles Davis, will argue that it ends approximately at 1932. His uncle, he says, he fought with, because he said it ended in 1935. At any rate, many people agree that it began somewhere around 1920. So the period is from 1920 to 1932 for my purposes tonight. Before discussing the state of Afro-American music in New York City during this movement, it is very important to consider certain sociological, philosophical, cultural, and political factors which were at work during this period. Because it's in this environment that of these factors that Afro-American music developed at the time of the Harlem Renaissance. Because New York City was America's greatest artistic and economic center, Harlem, the black section of New York City, attracted young black artists and intellectuals from all over the United States and from foreign countries as well. In 1925, Alain Locke, professor of philosophy at Howard University, published an interpretive literary anthology entitled The New Negro. His work presented the artistic and social goals of the so-called New Negro movement and the cultural aspects of the Negro struggle as portrayed in the works of artists and writers in Harlem during the 1920s. The Harlem Renaissance was primarily a literary and philosophical movement and constituted attitudes and ideals which had been gathering strength since the late 19th century. It was the upsurge of creativity inspired by those attitudes and ideals and by the general iconoclastic spirit of the times. The political developments of the time were parallel and independent from the same source that nourished the Harlem Renaissance, namely the increasing development of black awareness and pride. The most zealous and dramatic political leader of black people of this period, not the only leader, but one of the most colorful figures, was the West Indian Marcus Garvey. Lights. Here he is shown riding through one of the main streets of Harlem when his movement has grown to quite gathered quite a following. He's in an open air car here, and it shows you some of the flair of his style, which he often presented himself in. The next slide shows mobilization on his part. You will notice the presence of women as well as men, and these are Garvey's troops. Garvey offered American blacks a militant program of separatism and a vision of mass return to Africa as a means of liberation and autonomy. The center of Garvey's political organization was Harlem. At first, he had only a handful of followers, as any movement has, but by the year 1920, his movement had grown to approximately 3 million members. Many poor people, as they give their all, so to speak, to their churches today, or in some areas of the country, they give their all for their funeral services, so that when they die, they may have the very best that is available, gave their a large amount of monetary support to Garvey's movement. And this was clearly one of the ways that he was most successful, because it does take economic power to do some things in this country. This movement that Garvey headed was clearly the biggest mass movement that black people had ever known before this time. Light. While Garvey had tremendous political appeal to many blacks, the argument between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington paved the way intellectually for the Harlem Renaissance. Washington urged blacks to develop practical skills as laborers, farmers, and craftsmen instead of attempting to compete with whites for professional and executive jobs. And to this end, he established the famous school Tuskegee Training Institute. Du Bois very strongly attacked Washington's philosophy, and he charged that in effect Washington had renounced higher education as well as the civil rights guaranteed by the Constitution, or supposedly guaranteed by the Constitution. A brilliant historian, critic, editor, and essayist, Du Bois was the first black man to receive a PhD from Harvard. In 1919, he organized the first Pan-African Congress. A meeting of black representatives from 15 nations attended this meeting, this Congress. During the period of the Harlem Renaissance, Du Bois was editor of a journal called Crisis, familiar to most of you, which was a publication of the NAACP. And the NAACP, of course, is an organization which he helped form. Now, on the literary side, which Professor Barksdale is ultimately more qualified to talk about than I am, but I will say a bit anyway, lead into the music. The Harlem Renaissance can be characterized generally as follows. Before the Harlem Renaissance, not many black novels were published in the United States. One of the problems that you used to run into, that I remember Charles Davis of the University of Iowa speaking about, was that you frequently had to pay for your own publication of your novel. Because as blacks weren't allowed to record in the early days, or they weren't allowed to be on stage, if they could get a white person to represent them, the same thing applied to a publisher and books. The risk was too high, because perhaps the intelligence was lacking. Perhaps I underscore that. Took them a long time to get around to realizing it wasn't the case at all. Incidentally, you have such things in music, like the first jazz recording, the recording of a jazz band done, was not of the great and immortal Joe King Oliver, as it might have been or should have been. Or Lewis, who is now dead, or Bunk Johnson, but it was of the original Dixieland Jazz Band, an all-white group, which had sat around, listened to the style in New Orleans, admired it and had not said, as the Rolling Stones said, that we listened to Muddy Waters and B.B. King, and this is where we got our inspiration, but came to Chicago, that is the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and claimed to have almost invented this new down-home, homeland style, and they were the first ones recorded. King Oliver was recorded about 2 years later. Mamie Smith was the first person on record as a blues singer. Perry Bradford, her manager, recalls how he tried and tried to get her a recording contract, and how there was just no way for black people to get recorded. And the idiom of the blues, or the form of the blues, was very attractive to the ears of the majority white power structure, but they wanted someone white to sing it and copy the style. And the choice was Sophie Tucker. But in the end, the whole thing backfired on the part of white people, because Sophie Tucker declined the offer and Mamie Smith sang the first cut, Crazy Blues. Just shows a little bit of the struggles that went on in the beginning. Back to the subject. Beginning with the year 1925, approximately, however, a significant number of writers were engaged in writing novels and other forms of literary art. Among the most important, and here I do not name all of them, but the most important and famous ones are Count A. Cullen, James Weldon Johnson, Arne Bontemps, and of course the immortal Langston Hughes. The Renaissance writers rejected the minstrel tradition in Afro-American literature with its caricatures and southern dialect, and there was a little bit of a struggle sometimes between them and Paul Laurence Dunbar, because some people felt that, and he did write what is so-called straight literature, that is not in this minstrel tradition. But many people felt that some of the beloved poems people have today, think of today, reminded them too much of slavery and were perpetuating a stereotype that they wanted to overcome. And I underline stereotype, that means that this is not the truth, and this is something that they wanted to overcome and show a different side. And this is the whole aspect of this movement, showing a new Negro, which is the exact title of Locke's anthology. The Renaissance writers likewise usually rejected overt propaganda and what they felt was racial rhetoric, and they felt that these things were obstacles to literary excellence. The writers generally articulated and portrayed a variety of events in everyday black life. We also find more specific references to such past and present things as the oppression of black people, starting from the very beginnings of our exile and enslavement from Africa up to their present day of that time. There are also, though, somewhat mystical references to Africa as the original homeland of black people. Now, when I say mystical, this is, it might be defined when you read some of it as, well, there's one point we must consider. Many of these people, I can't say all, because I don't know all of them hadn't been there, but many of them had never been to Africa. Many of them did not know the exact geographical outlines as precisely as we know today, and as we make it our business to know today, and as we go today, or hope to go today. This also presented a problem, because too often you have references to Africa north of the Sahara, and most of us came from the West Coast and definitely below the Sahara as a dividing line. So that's a little bit mixed up, but that at least is some reference to the homeland, the motherland. There is also mention in these novels of direct blues forms, blues pieces, ragtime, piano pieces, and even very detailed descriptions of performances of jazz and religious music are found in a number of black novels of this era. In the autobiography of an ex-colored man, there are several things that I used in one lecture, or several references to the storefront church and to the possession by the spirit and the shouting and the true religious fervor that you went on in the churches as people moved from the South to the promised land in the North, only to find that it was simply another type of broken dream. And many of these storefront churches were a type of poor black man's psychiatrist, besides being a spiritual and religious experience, because it was indeed a shock to many of them when they finally moved after the First World War to the North and found out things weren't so great after all. In fact, we're still living in that kind of situation, the carryover. On the black art scene, lights, please. On the black art scene, Aaron Douglas was one of the most highly respected painters of the time. His murals and book illustrations depicted past events in black history as well as contemporary experiences. This slide is one of his representation of Emperor Jones, one of the great theatrical works that was very popular during the time. This is the main figure, of course, here represented. If you carefully examine the pages of the hit of Alain Locke's anthology, The New Negro, you will find in between chapters certain graphic illustrations or decorations, all of which were intended by the painters or artists involved to have some reference or some capturing of a spirit of Africa. Next time you have your copy handy, check it just a little bit. Here is Aaron Douglas's The Spirit of Africa. Now, I want to point out still the problem that was going on during the time of the Renaissance, and it's the problem of black awareness, but not, of course, as completely as we hope we are aware today. If you look very carefully at this mural, you'll notice that the head, and here I have to step away from the microphone. I hope you can hear me. Can you hear me? You notice this looks like something that you would see on a Sphinx or in Egypt or in Arabic northern Sahara, African section. It does, the features, if you look at this thing, the slide is blurred, but it doesn't come out any clearer. If you could look at the mural that it was taken from, you can see clearly that this really doesn't exactly represent features and facial types so much of West Africa or even Africa below the Sahara to a large degree, but especially West Africa. I'm not saying that Aaron Douglas had this hang up particularly, because that would be a hazardous thing to say, since he was my teacher and I have a certain deal of respect for the man, and we have to consider him in the light of the times in which he existed. But what I want to point out to you is that there's still a lot of hang-ups with black people, because assimilation was still the goal of a number of blacks, despite the fact that Garvey had decided that this was not going to be his game at all. For example, when Perry Bradford, Mamie Smith's manager, went to the recording company to try to get them to do him a favor of recording Mamie Smith, he described her, in his exact words, as a light-complected, colored woman with brown, wavy hair. Perhaps he felt this might soften the blow. This is, the whiter you are, the better it is. That's the only interpretation I can make, because Mamie Smith, I've done a lot of research in this, and she's about as light-complected as I am. And her hair is about as brown and wavy as mine is. Comes nowhere close. But once old Perry got inside the door, it didn't really matter, especially when Sophie Tucker kind of, you know, cut out that. And that's pretty good. I'm glad at that. No offense to Sophie, rest her soul. Is she dead? Let's now get to the musical currents during the Harlem Renaissance, which I'm supposed to know a bit about, and leave the rest to Professor Barksdale. Recordings and anthologies of 19th century black religious songs, commonly known to most of you as Negro spirituals, became increasingly popular in the 1920s more than ever. These spirituals, Negro spirituals, the ones that you hear today sung by college choirs, actually I think the white choirs are beginning to sing them more than the black choirs, because the black choirs are singing gospel music to a large degree. At least there's a lot of emphasis in that, but black choirs do sing Negro spirituals. These beautiful harmonized arrangements that you hear, that is not the way they were sung during slavery. The harmony that you hear is a quasi-Euro-American harmonization. What happened was that people like John Wesley Work, who taught me at Fisk, used to go down, and I used to go with him, to some of the churches in the city, old churches, and tap some of the old members at that time. That was about 57, 61. And I went in about 58, I guess, 58 to 61, I went with him. He used to go down and tap some of the old brothers and sisters for songs that they heard their grandmother sing or their mother sing, or things like this. And he would write the melody down, and then he would ask how this was performed. And what he would be explained to him was that, well, we sang kind of in parts, but it wasn't like white music. It wasn't like classical music, because we really didn't get that close together in the parts, which means they didn't really have technically four-part musical harmony. And many times they were sung almost in unison. It's as if I said, let us sing all now, something like Precious Lord or Amazing Grace or something like that. And I had everybody in here start singing, and I said, sing it like you sing it in church. Now everybody would sing a general pattern of the melody, but everybody would have a little difference here and there, because we have a tendency in a certain type of black church that features gospel music exclusively to put a little moan in here and there. You know, in other words, if you're gonna sing Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior, you don't sing, Pass me not, O gentle Savior, hear my humble cry. You don't do that, you know. You gotta get the sister with the piano going, dum, 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 pass me not, oh gentle Savior. You gotta put a little, you know, well, I won't get technical on you, but I just say a little moaning in there, a little embellishment, a little ornamentation of the melodic line. Plus, you have to have a little bit of the beat in it. That's one thing that comes from the motherland. The tendency, the great preoccupation that we have with taking over or listening to what was around us, because everything that we brought with us was attempted, and I underscore that, to be wiped out from us. Didn't work, because what we did was take these things and make them over into our own individual compositions, and they became something entirely different. There are white spirituals, and they sound very different. One, for example, is Wondrous Love, and if you sing it the way it goes where I come from in Arkansas, I have to do this, and I'm not being offensive, I hope, to anyone, but this is the way it sounds, this is the truth, you know. I have to pinch my nose because I don't have a twang, and I don't have a nasal thing either. God, wondrous love is this, oh my soul, oh my soul. God, wondrous love is this, oh my soul. No, it's not funny, because that music, I mean, that is, we really shouldn't practice reverse snobbery. See, now I think I was the greatest, naturally. Because with the Miss Jubilee Singers, what we did was, we had a version. And what had happened during slavery is that the verses got reversed. And the first verse became the second verse. So we had a spiritual that went, when I was sinking down, oh my soul, oh my soul. When I was sinking down, oh my soul, oh my soul. That is the way it went. But that's the same tune I sang with the nose pinch and with different text. We just switched verses. And so these things do carry over. That's a direct way of the cross-fertilization between the two things. These spirituals that I'm getting back to, these four-part concert pieces that you hear, were largely the result of black men, Harris E. Burley, John Work, William Dawson, who is still living, Nathaniel Dett, to mention a few, who were trained in colleges set up by various missionary societies, various abolitionist groups, Fisk, Hampton, Howard, Tuskegee, name a whole bunch of them. These were colleges set up naturally, since the people who set them up were white, according to white standards. So the musicians who came and who were black learned European harmony, theory, counterpoint, arranging, and composition. So in approaching their own music and their own tunes, what they did was to take the melody and put the European harmony with it and even kind of change the melody to a degree, kind of take out a few of the twists, the curves, the melismas, the moans, the gospel sound that you would call, I would say, and make it straighter, because you heard when I sang, when I was sinking down, oh my soul, a gospel singer wouldn't do it exactly like that. He'd get even a little down, a little further than that. That's spiritual, and that's a spiritual rendition. And these men cannot be criticized, and this literature cannot be criticized, because if it were not for recordings that we have of the early 20th century, and the fact that we have these anthologies of this music, we would have lost, pretty much, in record, all of the music, or most of the music, that black people sang during the period of bondage. So this is part of the heritage, too. And it is not to be turned, their nose is not really to be turned up at it. It's a part, it belongs there, just like anything else. These are black people doing sort of the best they could, what they felt was right. Many of them felt that by making these slave songs more Europeanized, that perhaps this would underscore to what to them was an obvious fact, and that is that black people were capable of genius. And in doing this, such songs came out. Now, one of the songs that I'm going to play was recorded in around 1913 by the Fisk Jubilee Singers, one of the earliest groups, I believe the first group to go out and sing Negro spirituals. The title of the composition is Roll Jordan Roll. You will hear the holding back of the, on the part of the singers. You will hear the pulse that does not race so much. You will hear this four-part harmonic traditional background, European background. And you will also hear something that sounds as if it comes out of black people, but yet there is some restraint there. And all of it comes because of what I have said in a roundabout fashion before. Did you notice the diction too? I have a grandfather, 87 years old, and he's not uneducated. And he never says Jordan. The word is Jordan. Talk to some of your old grandfathers. The word was Jordan. Roll, Jordan, roll. But these people have, the whole syntax has been affected. The whole manner of diction has been affected. And it's roll, Jordan, roll. Roll, Jordan, roll. Now, they can get down when they get by themselves and talk, you know, among themselves. But in the performances, everything had to be as much like the concert European tradition as possible. That's going to change, and we're going to see that. Now, at the same time, songs were being recorded, which were predecessors of present-day black gospel music. I want to emphasize this is not gospel music, but this is a moving toward what we have today. One example of this style, which was recorded in 1927, was sung by Hattie Parker and a group started by Charles Pace called the Pace Jubilee Singers. If you go into any kind of research for early music of this time, you'll find that everybody takes up the name Jubilee after a while. There was Pace Jubilee Singers. There were a number of names stuck in front of that as Fisk had started the tradition before. But you will notice that this recording by Patty Parker and the Pace Jubilee Singers shows a greater expressiveness in use of rhythm, the rhythmic vitality is coming back much stronger. And also the vocal phrase should be listened to. You hear a fuller use of materials from the Afro-American musical traditions. If you compare Hattie Parker's voice to Bessie Smith's, you'll see a great similarity. If you listen to Bessie, listen to Hattie, and you hear a little bit of the sliding up to the note, nursing it a bit, and then falling over it. Not singing it straight. Not singing the same thing somebody sang the way that they sang it, but the true artistry lying in your ability to kind of vary what you're singing. And this is the essence out of which much of our music, vocal and instrumental, grows. But you will notice that we have not thrown off completely the educational training that has been given various people. Because you'll notice that the sound of the traditionally trained European choir style group is still retained. The title of this is Take Your Burden to the Lord and Leave It There. Gotten Mamie Smith into the studio, and her voice was heard to be of good quality, and she had actually paved the way for Bessie and many of the others. She was the one who actually did it. Her voice wasn't as good as Bessie's, but she still paved the way so that black people could at least get in the door and make some money off of records. Then it suddenly occurred to the publishing companies, I mean the recording companies, that black people were buying these records, and that there was indeed a market, a black market. And this struck them, something they might should have realized. It's a very intelligent way of thinking about things, but racism isn't intelligent. It isn't rational even. And as soon as they found out they could make a few coins from blues singers and other people, religious singers, they started race recordings, number of recordings that were put out for whites if they wanted to buy them, certainly. But they were put out specifically in black neighborhoods, and they would flood the market. And there are tales that I hear up in Chicago about from old people that I go to interview when I do work with Dorsey, and they talk about, oh, we used to stand around the corner, around the block, about three times waiting for Bessie's latest cut to come out. And we didn't know who Paul Whiteman was. And Paul Whiteman, to the majority of the people in the country, meaning most of the white people, was it. But the black people knew about Bessie. And they waited there just like we wait to see what Aretha's going to do next. You know, because she seems to always be coming up with something different, and she never seems to fade out on us. There was as much interest in religious singing as there was in secular song styles like the blues. And among the most popular people to be recorded was the Reverend F.W. McGee. Reverend F.W. McGee was a preacher, obviously, a man who recorded sermons along with individual songs. And in the example of Reverend McGee that I'm about to play, you'll hear them really open up and break away from what the example I first played, even the second example. You'll hear him accompanied by a group which is made up of a piano, a triangle, and a trombone. And this is a religious song. You might not know it was religious if you didn't hear the Lord or Jesus a few places here and there. The use of the trombone here is quite interesting because although such instruments were rarely used in most white Protestant worship services, many black churches employ them frequently and certainly have continued to do so up to the present day. But this isn't the case in most of your white churches. Jesus the Lord is a Savior, recorded in 1929 by Reverend F.W. McGee. Quite strong during the Renaissance period. You heard one thing there. You heard that trombone tailgating, sliding up to those notes, which is something that started way back in the very, very beginnings of jazz. There are various theories as to how the tailgating effect actually got into jazz. One theory, which I'm not really sure about. Has this mic been off all the time? One theory that I heard that I'm not really sure about, but it's, at least it's a good tale to tell, is that the trombone player, uses a slide. Most of you know what one looks like. And he used to, in some of those funeral processions, they didn't always walk. And sometimes they'd get on the wagon. Now, with regular instruments beside the trombone, you're in good shape because you have keys and valves and things, so you don't have to extend your hand anywhere, unless you're going to play the violin, and they usually go for that much. And some of those, didn't you ramble, you know, where they do the strut, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, on the way back from the funeral in New Orleans, that kind of thing, you can still see that. Well, the trombone player, if he was riding in a wagon which had a tailgate, was had a problem, so legend has it, because they wanted to if they were playing a song, they wanted to give it a certain little lip, da da dum da 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 dum dum ba da da dum da da, that's a trombone, dum da 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 dum dum da 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 dum dum ba. In order to do this, he has to pull out that slide, and the back of the wagon is in his way. And they, of course, it's let down, and he has more freedom. Now, that's supposedly one legendary story of how tailgating arose in music. I think it's highly speculative, but I thought it might spice up the lecture a little bit. Nevertheless, the use of that trombone in that religious song and the triangle does show close relationship between sacred and secular practices. But we can see something that's even greater. Sister Ernestine Washington is going to sing a number for us next. And she is accompanied by the famous jazz musician Bunk Johnson and his band. And she's singing Did I Wonder. And I own the recording somewhere, it's under here somewhere. And I was playing it. It's called An Introduction to Gospel Song. It's put out, I think, on Folkways. And the record was new, and I was listening to all these religious songs and got to this one, and I thought, what's this jazz piece doing on here? And I could not literally tell it was a sacred song until I think I heard her say, it wasn't Jesus, it wasn't Lord, it was something like, save my soul or something. She gets further down the piece. I don't think you'll hear that particular section, but you'll hear enough to hear it's religious. Just about the time the tape cuts off. This example is a direct indication of a mixture of these two styles, and I think the best evidence of that is to simply play it. To cut out the good part. During the pleasure bent era of the 1920s, black music created quite a sensation, and New York's high society white flocked in the evening to hear jazz and blues in the cabarets and bars of Harlem. And many a hard working soul who had to get up before the break of day and work almost till sundown was awakened from his sleep by the dilettantes and, anywhere from very comfortable to wealthy people who came to hear these musicians. And these people really lived hard. You remember now, this is Prohibition going on. So they're coming for entertainment, and they also come to get sometimes, and I underscore that, there's a many blind person walking around, the safest nectar of the grape, or is it, what do they make the other stuff from? I don't know.
Grain,
thank you. They came to get this type of entertainment, and the liquor went along with it. And it was safer to get it there than to buy it off the corner in many cases. One of the things that killed some of the great jazz musicians as far as their outlets of places to go was the Depression, which followed immediately. Because with the repeal of Prohibition and Depression too, people didn't have money or time to spend that much. And some of those wealthy people were not so wealthy anymore. Some of them actually took their lives because it got too painful to live like many people had been living for centuries. One of these favorite clubs that they used to flock to are among the favorite clubs that they used to flock to were Small's Paradise and the Linux Club, Connie's Inn, which is now still standing, but is, I think it's either a pharmacy or it's a bowling alley. The only reason I mention this is because I gave a speech on this. And the granddaughter of the original owner of Connie's Inn was in the audience. And I was talking on and on about Connie's Inn and who went there and who sang there and who played there. And she, of course, was the whole rundown. And I made two or three mistakes. And from that time on, I decided I'd better check my information kind of carefully because I never would have known this. The Cotton Club, of course, was very, very popular. And this was the place, of course, that we know Duke Ellington from in his earlier days. The next slide will show you the fact that the word Renaissance was not only used or reflected in literature, but it even has extended here to the club itself. If you will look very hard, again here you cannot see this probably from the very back. This was called the Tenio Club or Tenio Club at one time. And during this period, the man changed the name to the Renaissance Casino, and the farms next to it, which I suspect was owned by the same person, was called the Renaissance Pharmacy. This is the interior design of one of the rooms of the Renaissance Club. Again, it shows one of the hang-ups and not the total being totally comfortable with being black African descendants. This is called the Arabic decor room, and it's not that either, but it somehow points up still this problem that a number of the people during this period have with anything that represents Africa below the Sahara, which is exactly where we came from. You will find references to Egypt. Not saying that blacks were not there, we all know that. But in contrast to today's movement, where we speak more of Nigeria and Ghana and Dahomey and places like that, these references do strike us, would strike one when you're researching. The next slide is that of Fletcher Henderson, one of the great jazz musicians of this period, and his band. The Renaissance Club, which I just flashed, was the place where Fletcher Henderson's band received its first enthusiastic reception and fame. I want you to notice very carefully the young man standing in the middle in the background, the one who was born July 4th, 1900. I think that's significant. Louis Armstrong, when he moved from King Oliver's band in Chicago, was talked into this because he really was quite good and wasn't getting the proper exposure, and went to New York to join Fletcher Henderson, who was seated here at the piano. This is Charlie Dixon, the great banjo player. Don Redman, who went on to do his own, form his own group and become famous in his own right. Here we have Buster Bailey, who's a very good reed man, and is anybody there else there that you need to know about? Oh, Coleman Hawkins, of course, here. Most of us know that the Harlem Renaissance, of course, coincides with the era of the great classic, so-called classic blues singers, the group of women who took over commercially the market of the blues, the period when men were not given that much of a chance to sing in nightclubs or in cabarets. There were recordings made, such as Blind Lemon Jefferson was recorded at near the same time that Bessie Smith was recorded, but
In general, the women had the spotlight. In Blues People, you will find a reference by the author of a hypothesis. Can I have the lights, please? Of why this might have been true. And this is only his hypothesis. I cannot support it, but I cannot say that I disbelieve it. The style of the period was one in which the women were dressed very, very well, very seductively, very beautifully. They were singing in places where liquor was served. They mingled with the customers. Most people brought their, usually their girlfriends, sometimes their wives, to these places. I'm just being blunt. And there was a certain appeal that the singer would have to the audience. It's the age-old thing of the country being run then as it is now by a white male power structure. So this hypothesis of Blues People presents the theory that it was fine for the woman, a beautiful black woman, or a black woman dressed up beautifully, to be in the spotlight, and sometimes a rather sexy and sensuous role. And it was fine for a white man to gaze upon her, and of course his date went along with it, or else I guess she walked home. But the reverse, a black male, could not happen. This is one of the theories that he gives. One of the other theories given is simply that once one of the women had taken over, a number of the other producers got the same idea and started grabbing. So you get Alberta Hunter and Victoria Spivey and Ida Cox and all the other singers. Which theory is true, I don't know. I think there's a bit of truth in both of them. The first blues recording of a singer took place on August 10th in 1920. And the singer was Mamie Smith, as I have said, and he cut Perry Bradford's tune, Crazy Blues, on the OK label. This gives you some idea of what I'm talking about when I say the style was fun-loving, a bit flamboyant. It was a glamorous type of setup that these women were put in. This is a slide of Mamie Smith and her jazz hounds. These people were accompanying her, and it gives you somewhat of an idea of the flair and the decorum of such performers of this era. Now that may not look so hot to you, but back then, that was saying something. I point out, this is a publicity picture that they took. They never played in these positions. As some of you who are musicians out there know, just from common sense and having played a lot. Lights. Among the most famous blues singers were Ma Rainey, Alberta Hunter, Victoria Spivey, and of course the magnificent Bessie Smith. These singers did not replace the earlier folk blues tradition of the deep rural South, but they expanded this rural folk tradition into an entertainment form which to a great extent merged with the jazz style of the period. In other words, they changed the setting of the environment of the blues styles, the blues songs, from a country to an urban setting. And it's the first instance we have of the urban blues before Muddy Waters, B.B. King came from the country up to the city with an entirely different type of urban blues, too. The following recording by Bessie Smith, entitled Standing in the Rain, was recorded in 1928 and is one such example of this confluence. Philosophical, political, and artistic currents of the Harlem Renaissance. A similar situation occurs in the musical world. Jazz and blues performers were not untouched by the Harlem Renaissance, by the works of Langston Hughes, or by Garvey's Marching Men. Although few of the musicians went so far as actually becoming Garveyites, they affected this Neo-Africanism and they were affected by this Neo-Africanism and by the general rise of black people's consciousness of their ethnicity. Thus, some performers went so far as to don pseudo-African costumes during the course of a performance, and I wonder if you know who this is again. Lights. Anybody want to take a guess as to who that is? That's Louie. Well, that's good, because that's the first audience that's ever recognized that. The grin does give it away somewhat, the facial thing. Tropical motifs were also used to decorate advertisements of jazz performers. But again, the relationship, the authenticity of such things didn't really hold true. These tropical motifs could have come from Hawaii as well as from Africa. This is Duke at the Cotton Club, where he made a great success. This is the program here. And you'll see the palm trees in the background. You'll notice that the lady, the man's face is shaded here, and the woman's is not. Think back to the time when dark black men with prestige felt that it was of utmost importance or was a big thing, at least, to marry light woman they could find. I wonder if there's any correspondence. A number of musicians gave their compositions titles which referred to Africa, such as Congo Stomp, Jungle Heat. The following recording by U.B. Blake, very well known during the period, entitled Sounds of Africa, was recorded in 1921. And this really shows that sometimes, and not too infrequently, the only discernible connection with Africa found in these compositions was the title itself. This recording, this music, shows no definite African or even pseudo-African elements. It's simply a ragtime composition, and a rather simple ragtime composition at that. But it's entitled Sounds of Africa. should note that part of the motivation for the frequent use of such terms as Congo, African, and jungle was of a purely commercial nature, taking into account the fact that the well-paying customers, most of whom were white, took a strong liking to the so-called exotic things. For example, during this time, there had been a flair for the exotic, and this had manifested itself in earlier in the century in a great preference for pseudo-gypsy music. James Reese Europe, a black man who played in one of the earliest syncopated orchestras, tells a story of how he fought so hard to get his band into hotels playing in the lobbies or for various occasions, and that during that particular time, early in the century, they didn't want to hear that. That what they wanted to hear was, you know, the strolling man with the violin playing what they felt or what was put upon them as gypsy music. You also must realize that Rudolph Valentino was alive at this time, and how many times have we seen him as a sheik or as some sultan, and all the other movies that were going on and that dealt with faraway places. And if, I think Life magazine had a whole issue, a whole thing devoted to nostalgia, and pointed up a number of these things. So a lot of this has to bear, should be brought to bear upon the particular point that I am trying to make. This fact is important, this exotic love of things, because we need to evaluate the single purely musical feature which is found in the music of this time and could be said to show African or pseudo-African influence, namely the so-called jungle or jungleistic sounds. And I'm quoting these because these are names that were given to the sounds by both the performers and the listeners. These sound effects, consisting of wah-wah and growling sounds produced by the wind instruments, the trumpet, trombones, were actually much more likely, if you think about this and listen to the example which follows, a continuation of the singing and instrumental traditions of the country blues and other varieties of black country music. The term jungle sound seems to have arisen only after this technique had been introduced into the music of the Harlem Renaissance. Partly, no doubt, because it was felt to be, quote, African, but partly also because of its publicity value. That the wah-wah and the growling effects of the jungle sound did indeed probably originate in the country blues can be seen if one compares a recording of an early or proto-blues type, especially, notice the harmonica here, compare this proto-blues or early blues type with a recording of a fully developed blues form sung by Sarah Martin and accompanied by the Clarence Williams Orchestra entitled Mean Tight Mama. If in the one sung by Sarah Martin, Mean Tight Mama, compare the trumpet technique with the proto or early blues type, the harmonica in the proto or early blues type. Compare the trombone, the trumpet technique of the fully-fledged blues form with the harmonica of the earlier blues style composition sung by Joe Pugh. And the title of it is Levy Camp Reminiscences. I'll play the earlier one and then the later one. And I think you'll see a similarity between the two things, or here. The harmonica is particularly important.
Okay, now Sarah Martin with a full-blown blues song. And listen to the trumpet here and compare it to what you heard on the...
rather than as an outgrowth of traditional jazz will be especially apparent if we compare the blues which you just heard with the following purely instrumental and non-bluesy jazz performance of the same band. That band backing Sarah Martin was the one of Clarence Williams. And that's the way they played when they played with a blues singer. The next thing you're going to hear is this same band playing a jazz number. And watch how the technique changes. The title of the composition is I'm Going to Take My Bimbo Back to the Bamboo Isle. Tradition, or the jungle technique of the blues tradition, pardon me, as well as its more swinging rhythm, its greater emphasis on the individual, its more monodic character merged with the earlier jazz tradition, and to a large extent put out of this early jazz tradition its choppy rhythm. If you listen to some early stuff with King Oliver, you hear that tuba just humping away, chomping away, and it gets in the way of a smoother beat. When you get the tuba thrown out, you have the bass put in, and you have the cymbals going chomp, 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 chomp. You can dance a little better to that than you can to what King Oliver was doing, but not saying he was necessarily a bad musician. He was just a man who lived in a different time. We also have an ousting of a straight way of playing, a clean style of playing, and more of improvisation and a dirty attack. This is the way the musicians describe what they do themselves. Not hitting a note exactly on the head, but sliding into it and messing around with it and then easing back into the particular tone that you want to get. There's also collective improvisation and much more polyphonic character. Now, what ultimately resulted from this marriage of blues and jazz during the time of the Harlem Renaissance is already clearly visible at the end of the period. The following recording by Chick Webb and his orchestra, entitled Let's Get Together, already shows all the earmarks of swing, which is the period which follows in the 30s. Here you hear a smooth, swinging 4/4 beat, the replacement of the old tuba with the string bass, which is much more flexible, gives you much more rhythmic verve, possibility of more. Solo improvisation, which is harmonic as well as melodic. The interplay between soloists and between different sections of the orchestra. You've seen these you know, first one section stand up and then answered by another one. And even the costumes change. You get this shiny satin outfit that Duke's Orchestra wears so much during the 30s. I haven't looked at very many of the others, but in going through an old book of photographs in a museum-type library in Chicago, you could tell the change of period by the type of outfit that was worn, not the type of dress, but the type of costume that the band wore. There is also a rich and frequently varied performance style, and one particular stamp is not used as a mark for any particular time or place. And a number of other characteristics I think you'll pick up simply from hearing my last composition, which will end the state of what I have picked up of part of the state of Afro-American music during the time of the Harlem Renaissance. This is Chick Webb and his orchestra playing Let's Get Together.
Before Professor Boxville comes on, I would like to make a few important announcements. As you know, Nikki Giovanni will be here on Sunday, April 9th. In order for you to attend that performance, which will be at Cranmer, if you're registered for the lecture series for credit, you must come to 512 East Charmer to pick up your ticket. We have tickets reserved for you. Now, if you've already, you can also pick up tickets at Cranmer or at the Afro-American Culture Center, I believe at the Union. However, if you're in the course, there is a ticket there for you at 512 East Charmer. So come by anytime tomorrow or Friday. Okay. Okay, Professor Barstead.
We moving the piano. I'll start singing real soon. Sister Hawk is a hard act to follow. Move it over a little bit more so that my profile can be seen. That's fine. I just want to see if it's in tune. That was the first part of the English 260 blues. The second part will be played tomorrow in the section meetings when the test is passed back. The hour is somewhat late, and I don't want to keep you here. I know many of you have places to go and drinking to do and assignations to make and so forth. So I'm going to move along. I thought that we ought to make one or two points about the uniqueness of the Harlem Renaissance in terms of geographical location. I don't think this is what happened in Harlem has ever happened before in a section of a metropolis anywhere in the world. First time the black man assembled in great numbers in a section of a large metropolis on some very valuable real estate. And as a result of the great migration during and after World War I. In 1915, for instance, there were 50,000 blacks in Harlem. By 1930, there were close to 200,000 blacks in Harlem. And this had never happened before in any other major urban area anywhere in the country. So Harlem became, from 125th up into the upper 150s, from the East River to the Hudson River, the most valuable piece of real estate black America had ever known. And in terms of sheer physical volume, the capital, Harlem became the capital of the black world and the Mecca. And that's the reason why during the 20s, everyone who could pack a bag, hop a train, or get a bus came to Harlem. They came on boats from the West Indies, McKay and Garvey and Warren. And from California came Thurman, Louise Thompson, and Anna Bontomp. And from Florida, the Johnsons. J. Rosamond Johnson and James Weldon Johnson and Zora Neale Hurston, and from the Middle West, Langston Hughes and many, many, many others. So Harlem became a place of color and excitement. Professor Hawk has told you about how the musicians gathered all the way from New Orleans and Chicago and every place else in the nation. And Harlem became, for the black man, therefore, some place to be somebody. Now, very recently, we have a sort of reaction against the Harlem Renaissance, a critical reaction. There's a book by Nathan Huggins entitled The Harlem Renaissance, in which charges are leveled against the Renaissance. It says, one charge is that actually, in the Renaissance, there was no cultural cohesion. There was no one, evidently, who could give or provide an organizing aesthetic, give evidence of some kind of artistic togetherness. The charge is made that you had a lot of artists who were doing, each one doing his thing in his way, but there was no centrality to the movement. Not only does Huggins make that charge, but Cruz makes that charge in his Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. Cruz kept citing Langston Hughes as the man who should have made the synthesizing statement. He never did. The second charge is that the Harlem Renaissance couldn't have amounted to much because it collapsed too quickly. After 10 years, about, it was over. And according to Huggins, this says that This indicates that either Locke, with his essay on the New Negro and the survey graphic in 1925 and other comments later, was too naive about social and economic realities, or overly optimistic. The third charge made against the Harlem Renaissance has been that it never became a truly racial renaissance. It was locked in to Harlem. It never spread out to Washington, D.C. and Chicago and other places. And therefore, no new Negro truly emerged. The fourth charge was that the white literary establishment, though it cooperated in a sense by publishing the works of blacks at this time, the white literary establishment looked at the literary and artistic activity of Harlem as some bubble that burst harmlessly, leaving matters pretty much as they were, that nothing really changed as they moved into the 1930s. And then the final charge made is that by no means does the Harlem awakening compare favorably with the literary and artistic awakening in black America in the 1960s and still continuing on into the 1970s. Renaissance II, as some people call it, is a much fuller and grandiose movement than what obtained in Harlem. And Harlem, the Harlem Renaissance in this context becomes what one critic calls a sad example of ethnic provincialism, a movement unsustained by social, political, and economic support. Now, I'm not going to take time out now to try to answer these charges. All I say to you is that they can be refuted, and they are refuted if you buy Professor Kinnaman and my book in April 1972. It's all laid out. The Harlem Renaissance was still a unique movement. It had never happened before, and it has never happened again. And it started things, and without the Harlem Renaissance, probably we wouldn't have had some of the things that developed later. Now, what are some of the salient features, literarily speaking? Well, social protest. There have been social protests in black literature before, but never like this. Let me read a poem to you. In 1919, there were a lot of lynchings and riots. As a matter of fact, some historians say that 1919 was the bloodiest year that black America suffered since the Reconstruction days. And one articulate young poet, Claude McCaid from the West Indies, in reacting to the bloodshed of 1919, wrote this sonnet. And it's a very, very well-wrought sonnet. It's entitled, If We Must Die. If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our cursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, fighting back. Now, in my class, I told the students how Winston Churchill read this in the dark days of 1940 when Hitler was knocking on England's door. I won't read it all, but I don't look like Churchill, but close your eyes. Oh, kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave. And for their thousand blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous pack, murderous cowardly pack. Pressed to the wall, dying, with fighting back. Now, one or two other salient features and a couple of poem readings to as examples of these. There was in the Renaissance a concern for black folk motifs. A good example was James Weldon Johnson's poem. It was published in 1927. You know, at this age, things happen to you. It was part of, forget the title. Well, anyhow, Go Down Dead. It's a little late to talk about this when some of you are sleeping and might wake up screaming. But this is a good example of how a well-trained man of literature dealt with the folk material. There's no dialect in this poem, but it's the way, through the rhythms, you get what the black preacher would have said. And it's about it's a funeral sermon. God's trombones. Weep not, weep not. She is not dead. She's resting in the bosom of Jesus. Heartbroken husband, weep no more. Grief-stricken son, weep no more. Left lonesome daughter, weep no more. She's only just gone home. Day before yesterday morning, God was looking down from his great high heaven, looking down on all his children, and his eye fell on Sister Caroline, tossing on her bed of pain. And God's big heart was touched with pity, with the everlasting pity. And God sat back on his throne, and he commanded that tall, bright angel standing at his right hand, call me death. And that tall, bright angel cried in a voice that broke like a clap of thunder, call death, call death. And the echo sounded down the streets of heaven till it reached way back to that shadowy place where death waits with his pale white horses. And death heard the summons, and he leaped on his fastest horse, pale as a sheet in the moonlight. Up the golden street death galloped, and the hoofs of his horse struck fire from the gold, but they didn't make no sound. Up death rode to the great white throne and waited for God's command. And God said, go down, death. Go down. Go down to Savannah, Georgia, down in Yamacraw, and find Sister Caroline. She's borne the burden and heat of the day. I'm warming up now. She's labored long in my vineyard, and she's tired. She's weary. Go down, death, and bring her to me. And death didn't say a word, but he loosed the reins on his pale white horse, and he clamped the spurs to his bloodless sides, and out and down he rode to heaven's pearly gates, past suns and moons and stars on death's road. And the foam from his horse was like a comet in the sky. On death road, leaving the lightning splash behind, straight on down he came. While we were watching round her bed, she turned her eyes and looked away. She saw what we couldn't see. She saw old death coming like a falling star. But death didn't frighten Sister Caroline. He looked to her like a welcome friend, and she whispered to us, "I'm going home." And she smiled and closed her eyes, and death took her up in like a baby, and she lay in his icy arms, but she didn't feel no chill. And death began to ride again, up beyond the evening star, out beyond the morning star, into the glittering light of glory, onto that great white throne, and there he laid Sister Caroline on the loving breast of Jesus. And Jesus took his own hand and wiped away her tears, and he smoothed the furrows from her face, and the angels sang a little song, and Jesus rocked her in his arms and kept her saying, "Take your rest, take your rest, take your rest. Weep not, weep not. She's not dead. She's resting in the bosom of Jesus." Well, that's an example. That's an example of a very polished literateur who became concerned with the authentic revival of black folk materials. Now, there was also a concern with the low-life milieu during this time, and I want to read one poem that deals with that. It's by Langston Hughes. A pimp is dying. You know what a pimp is, or was? I don't think they have pimps today. But a pimp is dying. I don't know whether you've ever been to a pimp's death before, but it's something else. I'm telling you. This is Sylvester's Dying Bed, a poem by Langston Hughes. And Sylvester, as the folks say in the local idiom, has many women's. And Sylvester's speaking. "I woke up this morning about 3:30. All the women's in town was gathered round me. Sweet gals was a-moaning, 'Sylvester's gonna die.' And 100 pretty mamas bowed their heads to cry. I woke up a little later, about 4:30. The doctor and undertakers both at my door. Black gals was a-begging, 'You can't leave us here.' Brown skins crying, 'Daddy, honey, baby, don't go, dear.' But I felt my times had come, and I knowed I was dying fast. I see the river Jordan a creeping muddy past. But I still sweet Papa Vesta. Yes, sir, long as life do last. So I hollers, 'Come here, babies, for to love your daddy right.' And I reaches up to hug him, when the Lord put out the light. Then everything was darkness in a great big night." Langston Hughes, you know, felt that much of his inspiration came from low-life folks. And in this regard, he upset many people who were the so-called bourgeois critics during the time. Now, Sister Hawk has talked about black history and Africa and so forth. I just want to make one point, that a lot of the Africa, I think she made the point, a lot of the Africa emphasis was a sort of a pseudo-exoticism. It had not much to do with Africa. I think she made that point quite clearly. In Harlem, you'd go to a nightclub, there would be a girl with some feathers on, and she would shake them and a drum would beat, and that was Africa. Of course, that has really nothing to do with Africa. It's a sort of a false sort of exoticism. Now, but the greatest contribution in the Harlem Renaissance had to do with the discovery of black soul. We tend to believe that soul was, you know, discovered in the 1960s. But there's a whole lot of soul in Langston Hughes's Mother to Son. Well, son, I'll tell you. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks in it, and splinters and boards torn up, and places with no carpet on the floor bare. But all the time, I've been a-climbing on, and reaching landings, and turning corners, and sometimes going in the dark, where there ain't been no light. So boy, don't you turn back. Don't you set down on the steps, cause you finds it's kind of high. Don't you fall now. I'm still going on, honey. I still climb. And life for me ain't been no crystal stair. And I think Langston Hughes gets down to it, too, with "The Negro Speaks of Rivers." This is a whole lot of history here. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood and human veins. My soul has grown deep like the river. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep, like the rivers. And then finally, as a sort of an anti-climax, I want to read the Weary Blues. Langston Hughes picked the Weary Blues as his the title for his first volume. Now, Sister Hawk has told you all about the blues, but I just want to make, if she'll permit, one addendum. Blues has to do with pain and suffering, trouble. You got to have trouble to understand the blues. Back in slavery times, you know, the man ran away, and sometimes he didn't get very far, just into a clump of trees off from the plantation. He'd stay out there until he got hungry and come back in. He was usually hung up in the barn and beaten. And after he was beaten and cut severely by the whip, the sisters would take care of him by rubbing lard into his wounds. And on some plantations, they had a lardy house. Not a lardy house, but a L-A-R-R-D-Y house. And they'd put the poor victim in this house, and he'd roll in pay. 12, 14, 15 hours. And of course, the lard would cook his wounds so that you'd get this ridge. You've seen pictures, I guess, in some of the, in Bodkin's Lay My Burden Down, you've seen pictures of the beaten backs of slaves. But sometimes in pain and suffering, in the Lardy house, he would sing an early, early blues. Lord, 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 when my trouble's gone in. Lord, 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 when my trouble's gone in. And he'd sing all day, because that's the only way he could stop the pain. See, that's really where the blues came from pain and misery and suffering. Then probably, if you follow this story, this man probably lived to get out of slavery, father some children. And maybe 20, 25 years later, during the Kansas migration, his son probably stood out there, whipped by the icy winds of Kansas, with no place to go, no house, no shelter, because the white folks had burned up the lumber they were going to use in Lawrenceville, Kansas, to Bill Holmes in 1879. So he sang, Lord, 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 what am I gonna do? So this, the history, the blues, is rooted in pain and suffering. Now, Langston Hughes knew about pain and suffering, but his situation, when he listened to this man playing the worry blues, Langston didn't feel bad, but he was somehow the mood of the piano player. And I was going to try to do this, but it's beyond my bedtime now. But I'll start it anyhow. What Langston's doing is taking the poetical medium and trying to communicate the anguish of the blues as this old man, without an audience almost, just played thump, thump, thump the worry blues, droning a drowsy syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of an old gas light, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Old blues, old blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Old blues, sweet blues, coming from a black man's soul. Old blues. In a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I's gonna quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. I don't know. Let's see. I see Langston, I'll make my apologies. And far into the night, he crooned that tune. The stars went out, and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed. While the weary blues echoed through his head, he slept like a rock for a man that's dead. Good night, y'all.
There will be a reception for Professor Boxdale and Professor Hawk over at ISR. If you have any questions at that time, I think we'd be glad to entertain them. Also, you can come up now if you like.
You got anything?